This is Shine On, the Health and Happiness Show, with new episodes every week on how to live well. Shine On is heard all over the world as a podcast, but it's heard first on the radio in New York's Hudson Valley. Hi, it's Casey. Thank you so much for tuning in to Shine On. I have just spent the last, half hour talking to our guest, and now we're going to talk together so you can hear it too. Mary DeTouris-Paust, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You are an author of 6 books, plus many other devotionals that are Catholic, and you've been working for the Catholic Church since 1984?
Yes. I started as an intern and I never left.
Wow. That's amazing. I can really relate to that because I started radio round about that same time as an intern and I never left until just recently when I moved up to the mountain at Graymore, which is where you will join us for a weekend retreat called The Journey is the Goal. But I just have to tell people what I'm seeing behind you. You have the most beautiful office and you've got beautiful prints of
My favorite women saints, lots of icons of St. Catherine of Siena, Mary Magdalene, the Blessed Mother, Dorothy Day, Joan of Arc, one of my heroes, Julian of Norwich, Hildegard, all my girls.
All your girls are here, but you also have, would I call those Buddhist prayer flags over your window?
Yeah, they're Tibetan prayer flags.
Tibetan prayer flags.
And the bottom ones, which you can see there, those are actually just little flags made in Guatemala when I was there last year. Wow. So I was on a retreat in Guatemala and I bought those at a cooperative as a little reminder. So they're sort of like my little prayer flags to remember those beautiful people that I met in Guatemala.
Yeah. So would you say you're an interreligious kind of soul?
I would say that I am deeply Catholic to my core. That is my, not just my identity, but it's my everything. My Catholic faith life is the heart of who I am. But I love to expand and sort of learn about other traditions and to bring some of those pieces that I feel like can strengthen my own journey into my own life. So I guess you could say I'm not afraid of like what other traditions may have to offer us that we can learn from.
Right.
So there's a lot of, and we have so much that in common, we have more in common really than we realize. Mm. So most of us are just trying to move forward and be good people and get to that place of union with God. And if I can learn something that will help me on that path, then I'm going to do that.
Right. Sister Peggy Murphy is one of our frequent speakers at Graymore, and she's going to do a whole weekend on world religions.
Oh,
yeah. A whole weekend. Yeah. Because, you know, the way she looks at it is similar to what you said. At the heart of all the world religions is really almost, to super simplify it, is the golden rule, yeah. Right? It's at the heart of every religion is to be good to each other. And she's going to take us on that journey. And we also have talked about there's so many different kinds of people. There's so many different kinds of nervous systems. There's so many different kinds of brain patterns and cultures, right? And histories. Yeah. Of course, there has to be different religions.
Different ways of praying. You know, that so some folks are just like really happy with those more traditional vocal prayers. That's their place where they feel comfortable. For other people, it's not always going to be the case. They may prefer silence. They may prefer some movement. Mm-hmm. When I did my book, Everyday Divine, that was very focused on how do we bring prayer into our life? And really, it's to do what St. Paul told us, which is pray without ceasing. So yes. We learn to bring prayer into the everyday motions of our life. And some folks are going to be very happy to be like in the traditional rosary prayer group, and other people are going to want to be in something a little different. So the beauty is that we have so many styles of praying that there's always something that fits everyone.
I work with a wonderful woman who always has her rosary beads on her desk. And I thought, wow, she's truly devout that she's always saying the rosary. And she says, no, I don't say the rosary. I just hold my rosary beads when I pray, and I feel like my prayers are heard better. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, everybody uses the tools in different ways.
Yes. And I used to say, years ago, I would say I was rosary challenged because even though my mother prayed the rosary when she was alive, my aunt prays it all the time. It was always a big prayer in my family, and yet it never felt like a prayer that worked for me. And then about 4 years ago, I would say, I was going to bed one night, and for whatever reason, I grabbed my rosary beads and I started saying the rosary. And now I almost can't go to bed without my rosary beads. Sometimes I may not even get past the Apostles' Creed. Other times I may get all the way around the set of beads, but I'm sort of the same way. If I'm holding them and I'm praying, I sort of feel like even if I fall asleep, that's okay. But it's a reminder that like a prayer practice that doesn't work for us at one point in our life may be exactly what we need in another point if we're just open, you know.
I too can relate to that being rosary challenged because I always forget, like, how do I start again? Let me
Which
Google that.
mystery?
What mystery? How do I do that? My mom, who is in amazing, wonderful health and just turned 95 yesterday, she says the rosary every day when she goes out walking, and she prays for different people,
Yes.
in our family. And she told me that when she dies, I have to carry on the tradition. I'm like, she says, I'm giving you
Right.
the list of people I pray for. I'm like, all right, hang around for a while longer.
Right.
I don't know. It's a lot of time to devote. We're talking to Mary DeTorres Paus, who is coming to Graymore for a weekend retreat called The Journey is the Goal. I'm going to say that again. The journey is the goal. Just those words, Mary, they give me, I take a breath and I say, yeah, slow down. What does it mean to you?
And yeah, this started almost out of my own experience, of I'm one of these people who's always, I always have a goal. I always say I'm never going to find a certification I don't want to do. Like I'm one of those people who's
Me too.
constantly signing up for another class, trying something new, getting a certification. So I am one of those people who's like constantly going for the goal, going for the goal. And the danger is that we can do the same thing with our spiritual life, so that we can get into that mindset of the regular world, which is I'm going to achieve, like I'm going to achieve something in my spiritual life. And I think we imagine that when we figure it all out, we're going to like get to this place where we somehow life isn't as hard. And we stay like in that mountaintop experience. And that's not the way life is. And it's kind of cool that we were recording this podcast this week because this week we're going to have the Feast of the Transfiguration. And to me, that ties in with this idea of the journey is the goal, right? Because Jesus takes them up the mountain and they get to have this experience of seeing Jesus transfigured. And, Peter, who I love because he's always just saying what comes to mind is like, let's build tents. Let's stay here. Like he wants to camp out. He wants to stay right where they are. And Jesus is like, nope, we have to go back down the mountain. So it's this reminder that even when we get those moments of connection with God that make us feel like we're on this mountaintop, life is not about staying on that mountaintop. We got to kind of take it back down into our daily life. And that becomes the pilgrimage. So taking away this idea that somehow we're going to be done with our spiritual journey when we like perfect it on this earth, because we're not, we're never going to finish the journey on earth. It's always going to be in front of us. So looking at our daily life as a pilgrimage is a way to kind of transform the journey through it, I think.
All right, we're going to look at all of that. When you're talking about this experience, we've all had those mountaintop experiences either in our faith or in some other way. Maybe on the sports field, or I'm thinking of Frankenberry, the producer of the show, who was a writer. Maybe when he's, writing his blog or his poetry, you have this experience where, man, I'm there, I'm in the zone. And then I don't know, you got to open a can of beans and make dinner or whatever the case may be. Like part of the human life is we don't get to stay on that mountaintop.
Right. No, I can't remember the author, which I'm sad about that, but I think there's a Buddhist book called After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. And it's this reminder that like, if you've achieved, and Saint Teresa of Avila, who we think of as this mystic in ecstasy, and her visions, and yet one of her famous quotes is, God moves among the pots and pans. So it's this reminder that like God is not just in those vision moments. God is where we are all the time. One of the quotes I used on this a recent retreat, which I'll probably be using again when I visit Graymore, is be where your feet are. That, like, where are you right now? Where are your feet planted? So our goal is just, the goal is not someplace way out there. The goal is where we are right here. Where, how do we find God right now, right where we are?
We're talking to Mary de Touris Paust. The retreat she's bringing to Graymore is called The Journey is the Goal. And I love that. After the ecstasy, there's laundry. And that sums it all up, because that's life. You know, we have those peak moments and then we have those other moments. And I love what you say about, you know, God is wherever you're standing. And what you're going to teach us, I hope, is how to remember that when both my phones are ringing and my emails popping and somebody's standing at my office door, you know,
yes.
How do I not flip my lid? Where do I find God? How do I find God in those moments?
And that's the thing. And I think we forget that, like, this, it require, we don't like the word discipline because it sounds structured and harsh, but yet we almost, we need to have, like, spiritual practices, spiritual disciplines that we are committed to that help us, like, remember to make that connection to God, whether it's through scripture or vocal prayer or mass or adoration or whatever, our silent prayer, whatever it is. But then we can weave things into that daily life that are not really difficult to do. And I will be talking a lot about gratitude when I come to Graymore. But, like, for me, the gratitude practice is going to be one of the greatest ways to start making little change in your life that really helps you recognize where you are by finding things in your daily life every day, just a few things that you can say, I am grateful for this thing. And it starts to, like, change our mind from a place of lack to a place of abundance. And when we start to do that, we begin to see our life differently. And I say all that not as somebody who has figured it all out. So whenever I lead a retreat, I always remind people I'm not, like, the expert who's got it all nailed down. Usually when I come up with a retreat, it's because I need to learn it too. So we journey together. We do it together.
Wonderful. Mary de Touris Paust is our guest. It's so great to finally be speaking with you, because we've been emailing for many, many months now, it seems. And I wasn't even sure how to pronounce your name. So now I feel like, all right, we're buds. It's good. You have been with the Catholic Church since 1984. You have all your icons behind you of these female representations of just, you know, divinity.
Yes, the witness to the faith.
The witness to the faith. Even with all this and all you have going on, do you ever have days, times, moments when you feel disconnected?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let me see. What time is it? No. And I think that's another thing we have to remind ourselves, which is we are going to feel disconnected. We may even feel doubt, you know, like, there may be times where something terrible is happening. You know, someone you love has a cancer battle or somebody dies and you find yourself in the throes of how can I be grateful? How can I have joy in my heart? How can I feel like, why is this even happening? Why would God allow this to happen? Like, these are all the things that come up for us that can throw us off that journey that we're on. And I think what our goal is, if we're going to have a goal, it's that knowing that there are going to be detours and switchbacks and mountains and valleys and darkness and light, and that it's okay to have those feelings of disconnect. And we know the great saints did. We know the great saints had dark nights and dry spells. And my goodness, we were also shocked when Mother Teresa died and we found out that she had been living with the spiritual dryness for so long, when all we saw was this selfless person who loved God. And a priest I know that I went on retreat with, Father Tom Ryan, I was on retreat. His statement was, be faithful to the rendezvous. Show up. You just keep showing up in prayer, even when you feel like you're disconnected, even when you feel like it's not working in our, we think it's not working, right? In our human mind. You be faithful to the rendezvous, meaning you show up every day. You show up every day, even when you don't necessarily feel like you want to.
Wow.
And God will be there. You know, God, there's another great saying, called or not called, God is present. Like, whether we're calling on God or not, God is there. And so God will be with us.
Beautiful. Of the six books that you've written, your first one was Parenting a Grieving Child. And I loved reading about it because, well, you tell people what that book was about.
Yeah. So, although I did not experience loss when I was, well, I did experience loss when I was young. My grandfather when I was 5, but when my mother died, I was 25 when my mother died. But I had younger siblings and younger cousins who were very close to her that then were going through a lot of grief. So grief became front and center for me because I was experiencing it in a really dramatic way, and I was watching other family members and young family members. So I started thinking about wanting to help children through this because most of the time they're sort of left to the side. Like people think they don't understand or they're not even really registering, and kids are registering. And if we don't help them through grief, they will manufacture something to get through the grief. And so for me, one of the most fascinating pieces of this was when I decided to write this book, I wrote down the story of what I remembered of my grandfather's death when I was 5. I had a very clear image. I start the book this way. I talk about like where I thought I was in a car with my grandmother who was on the porch. I had like absolutely clear memories of that day. And when I told my grandmother, she said, "None of that is how it happened. Like, that is not at all how it happened." And I was 25 years old, and I was finding out for the first time that I had created a story to fill in because that my Italian family really didn't like to talk about death. And so they kind of put that away over here. And so I really didn't have a lot of answers as to where he went and what happened to him. I just knew that now we would go to the cemetery and this is where grandpa is. And we would say, we're going to pray for grandpa in heaven. And so when I realized that I had created a story, then it really helped me to see this is what happens to children. And depending on their age, they may think they're at fault for something. Like if someone dies, they may think somehow they like magical thinking, like they caused it. Or they may think the person's coming back because they don't have that permanent understanding of how time works and how things work. And even teenagers, my brother was almost graduated high school when my mom died. So there's that feeling that they're grown up enough. And yet they're not. They're still children at that point. And so they often get lost in that grief process because they're caught between childhood and adulthood.
Yeah. Can children also feel like unworthy? Like, oh, if I was better, he wouldn't have gone, or maybe
Right. If I had done something differently, if I hadn't said, "I hate you," you know, like if a kid might say, "I hate you," and then something happens to someone, they can think that somehow their actions caused somebody to die. And especially when you're starting to talk about like a parent or a sibling, where you're talking about somebody like very, very close to a child and like an unlikely death, you know, like where it's not a grandparent is hard, but it's almost like in the trajectory of what we expect will happen. But even those like in the book, I talk about pets. And then when we revised and updated that book, Loyola Press had asked to revise and update it. We then included things that were not even death, things that are grief, that are like moving to across the country, a parent in military service, things that cause a separation from our life or cause us to feel like we've had a loss, even though nobody has died. So acknowledging that children and the fact that children will go through grief in a very non-linear way, most of us do, but they may like want to play at a time that seems inappropriate. Cry at another time, like things don't make sense. Like you'll be thinking, how could you want to play? Somebody just died, but they don't have that same sense of time as an adult would.
And also grieving over the violence in the world and grieving over bullying, right?
Bullying. And when the first edition of the book came out, 9/11 had really just happened, and we added in as much as we could at that point. And then sadly, by the time the updated version came out, we were dealing with just a long string of school shootings, you know, active shooter drills that kids have to go through, all of these things that have an impact on kids and affect them in a grief kind of way, even though they may not have had an experience of loss of somebody in their own school, you know, but it still affects them.
Parents and teachers want us to mention that the name of that book. I can hear them. Parenting a Grieving Child. Is that the full title of the book?
Yes. The subtitle is Parenting a Grieving Child, Helping Children Find Faith, Hope, and Healing After the Loss of a Loved One. And it's from Loyola Press. And it's really written, the updated version is designed to help the helpers. So people who are teachers, chaplains, working in a parish, maybe a friend, a neighbor, family member, because often people, when they're in grief, that's not really when they have time to go look for a book to help them. So they almost need somebody to put it in their hand and say, here. And it includes activities at the end of every chapter to help kids do different things that can help them go ahead and process their grief.
Beautiful. Wonderful. I just want to mention the other titles of your book, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Catholicism. Is that one?
Complete Idiot's Guide to the Catholic Catechism.
Okay.
And specifically on the catechism.
And then there's The Essential Guide to Catholic Prayer and Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And then Walking Together. What is that about?
That was about spiritual friendship, which is these connections we have with people that have sort of a spiritual core to them. And we see it in some of the saints, St. Francis de Sales and Jane de Chantal, St. Clare and St. Francis of Assisi. And we see it in others. You know, Thomas Merton had close relationships with like D.T. Suzuki or people in the Buddhist field. Like he had close relationships with them. So we see these places where spirituality becomes almost the thread that connects two people and how that can help them help each other along the spiritual path. So that was kind of an interesting one. And I will tell you one thing about the catechism book. When I was asked to do that, I really didn't know how I felt about it. You know, I hadn't read the catechism from cover to cover. I'd used it more as a reference tool. And then I had to take the entire catechism and break it down and explain it in what would be probably eighth or ninth grade level. So very hard sometimes to explain our faith in like a very simplified and yet clear way. And of course, it has an imprimatur, so it went through theologians, and I actually did it with a theologian as an advisor. But I always tell people that writing that book is the closest, as a lifelong Catholic, it's the closest I come to a conversion moment, because I spent so much time sitting with the beliefs that I profess week after week after week and having to dive down to like a much deeper level to try to explain everything, that it was the pivot point for me that made me go from one, I was really a Catholic journalist. I wrote for Catholic newspapers, to wanting to write spiritual things and be a retreat leader. So that was really the thing that sort of flipped that for me. It was like a desire to now talk about the faith.
Wow. That is a beautiful part of your journey.
Yes, it is.
Thank you for sharing that.
And unexpected, you know, I just took it as a job, you know, and then it kind of changed everything for me.
Wow, that's beautiful. Talk to people who have never done a retreat. Are we just going to be praying all the time?
No. So I really try to make sure I leave space. You know, it's important on a retreat to have that open space where you can pray. I always tell people, I send out a schedule, or I give people a schedule at the beginning of the weekend. And at the top of that schedule, it says, you are welcome to skip anything on this schedule. It is your retreat. So I would love for people, if they want to come to every single thing on the schedule, that's great. But if you need to nap or you need to go walk, then you should do that, because that may be where God is going to fill you up. You know, so most of us are so stressed and busy, and we rarely get that time to be on a retreat. So the last thing you want is to be like scheduled for every. That being said, we usually do something nice on a slow lead in on Friday night with like a nice, easy intro talk. And I usually do a guided meditation to sort of relax everyone. And then Saturday, there's usually a couple of main talks in the morning and the afternoon. And then I give people ideas for practices that they could do in their free time. So some folks want a lot of open space, and a lot of other people might be like, what am I supposed to do with all this open space? So I tend to give suggestions for activities if people wanted to do something a little more artsy, or they want to go pray a certain way. And then usually we do like some sort of optional activity on Saturday night. I'm hoping we'll do a movie on Saturday night of retreat. And then, of course, on Sunday, we'll have Mass and we'll have a closing talk, and also opportunity to share if you want, but you do not have to share if you don't want to. So I always want to stress that to people, like it's not a kind of retreat where you are going to have to speak and share things. Nobody has to speak. Usually there's enough of us in a group who like to talk.
We like to wrap up every Shine On show with a quote, and I think you should use the quote from Psalm 139. What was that you said before?
Psalm 139. about
I'm
being
fearfully and wonderfully made.
I'm fearfully and wonderfully made.
Yeah.
That's a
wonderful are your works.
What's that last part?
The wonderful are your works.
The journey is the goal. We'll see you in September at Graymore. Thank you, Mary Duturis Paus. Tell everyone your website again.
NotStrictlySpiritual.com.
NotStrictlySpiritual.com. Shine on.